Do you give your kids an allowance? What type of cell phones do your kids have, and who's footing the bill? Talking to your children about money can be weird and tricky, especially if you aren't sure how to get started. Many parents put these conversations off until their kids are headed to college and taking on thousands of dollars in student debt. Ron Lieber is the personal finance columnist for the New York Times. He's also a father. He has advice on how to tackle your children's questions about money, how to encourage responsible spending, and how to raise kids who are generous as well as financially wise. He joins us next on Midday to answer your questions after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us for our second hour today. Okay, think back to when you were a kid. Did you get an allowance? Did you? How much was it? And did you have to sort of earn it? Did you have to do chores for your allowance? What did your parents teach you about money? And when did those conversations start? If ever. And if you are a parent now, how do you talk to your kids about money? Or have you avoided the subject altogether? Do your kids have a cell phone? Who pays the cell phone bill? Do you tell your kids what the monthly charge for cell phones in your house is? Do your kids know how much money you earn? Do you think you'll ever tell them? 410-662-8780 is a phone number for Midday today. Ron Lieber is joining us. A parent himself, of course, a personal financial columnist, of course, for the New York Times. He says that too often parents are afraid to have conversations with their children about money. But these conversations, and that's conversations plural in Ron's book, are essential if you want to teach your children to save and spend responsibly. Many parents make the mistake of waiting until their kids start applying for colleges to talk about how it will be paid for. U.S. News and World Report reported that about 70% of the 2013 graduates left college with nearly $30,000 in debt. Ron Lieber argues that that's lunacy. It's lunacy that young adults who have never made any financial decisions get the final say on taking out those enormous loans. In his new book, I like this title, The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. That sounds great, doesn't it? Ron Lieber gives advice on allowances, part-time jobs, and how parents should tackle kids' tricky questions. Why does one child at school go without a cell phone while another has the latest model? Why can't I buy a pet, a motorcycle, or whatever if I pay for it myself? In this hour, Ron Lieber tells us how to break the ice and start talking dollars and cents with kids. Ron Lieber, it's nice to have you back on the show with us.
It's a pleasure and a privilege to be back. Thanks for having me.
Why do parents have such a hard time with this conversation, Ron? It's like sex and money, two things that parents have a hard time talking to their kids about.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of reasons that people might be reluctant. It probably starts with the way they were raised. And if they were never talked to about money, they may have come to the conclusion that it's not actually polite to speak of it. Or there may be shame. There may be shame on the parents' part about how they handle their own money. They're afraid of being found out. They're afraid of being called out for their ignorance. And then there's the protective instinct, the desire to shield kids from all of this real world stuff for as long as possible, which I think is loving and lovely. But I'm not sure that it isn't just a little bit naive, because kids are picking up on this stuff all the time.
Right. It starts when they're little. But let's go to college. Let's jump ahead to college, because I mentioned that there. A really interesting point you make, important point you make about how kids are, you know, and families are taking on all this debt to get them a higher education, get them bachelor's degrees, maybe even helping to finance master's degrees these days. And, you know, they just don't know about all of this. Do we have any information about how much parents share this information about college debt with kids before they actually graduate?
I'm not sure that parents grasp the full weight of it, because they may have gone to college themselves if they went at all. And this is, you know, particularly hard for first generation college attendees whose parents have no experience with the system. But, you know, parents who did go to college may have gone to school back in the day when it was much easier to pay for it, that you could work your way through a public university, mm-hmm. or your parents could pay for it out of current income, and that plus a small student loan would probably have been enough. But something very fundamental has changed in America, and a source of mine put her finger on it a couple of weeks ago when she said to me, you know, it used to be that there were only two things in our financial lives that we paid for over decades. We would pay for our home, mm-hmm. assuming we had a 15 or a 30-year year mortgage, and we would pay for retirement through 40 years or so of saving. She said college has now joined that list. And not only has it joined the list, you know, and in the very recent past at a time when we weren't really paying attention, but it actually might take longer to pay for than retirement. Because if you spend 20 years saving for college, you know, once you get pregnant with your kid, and then afterwards you take on these student loans, and maybe the parent takes on loans and the kid takes on loans and the kid consolidates the loans and you pay them off over 30 years, you're going to spend half a century paying for this stuff. Meanwhile, we've got kids who are 16, who are 17, leading the charge, or at least participating on an equal basis in deciding how much to pay for and how much to borrow. It is insane. And yet is the reality that we live in now. And so we have to get our kids ready starting at the earliest possible age so that when they confront these decisions, they have some context and some idea of what is worth spending money on.
Hmm. I was talking to a friend of mine a few weeks ago. We were comparing notes about financing colleges, and he was saying how when his children were just born, he had conversations with financial planners, multiple financial planners, about how to plan ahead, how to save for that. And the miscalculations were off by half. He said, that's what he said. He said I had half the money I needed to pay for college. I thought way back when, it was kind of shocking to hear the numbers, you know, 22, 23 years ago. But even then, he was off by half.
Right. I mean, it's so hard to know. I think, you know, particularly with public institutions that have had to raise their tuition in sort of an outsized manner, double the rate of inflation over the last decade because of the decline in state support. You know, it's just so hard to predict. It's hard to predict what tuition inflation will look like, and it's hard to predict how our investments will perform, and it's hard to predict how much we'll be able to save. You know, it's not to scare parents to death, you know, parents of young children. I mean, one way to think about this, right, is to use a formula that a financial planner named Kevin McKinley in Wisconsin uses. He suggests just thinking about it in terms of, you know, a third, a third, a third. You try and save a third of what you'll need. You try and spend a third out of current income during those 4 or 5 years that the kid is in college, and you just eat rice and beans the whole time and don't take any vacations. And then you borrow a third, and maybe the student borrows half and the parent borrows half. And you know, that starts to make it seem more manageable. But still, if you've got two kids, you want to send them both to private college, and you've got $200,000 or $300,000 worth of income, you're probably not going to qualify for very much need-based financial aid. But if you've got two kids who are ages 2 and 4, you may well be looking at $500,000 per kid by the time they are in college if things continue apace. It's frightening.
It is frightening. And I wonder if you have a sense of from parents that you talk to, because I know you speak a lot and you just interview a lot of people, and you also do a lot of your reporting based on the studies that are done on money and kids and parents. And the parents feel, where are parents on their obligation for higher education? I mean, it's a large question, I understand. Everybody's different. But do parents feel they're obligated to help their kids get through college, those who are college bound? Or do they feel like, I don't know, if I can't take on that debt, but I can let my son or daughter do it? Where are parents on that?
It is absolutely all over the map,
yeah.
And oftentimes parents are confronting it, you know, when their child is in high school, and so they haven't had a lot of time to really, you know, develop their own kind of philosophy and thinking and planning around it. So it can be extremely haphazard. Sometimes parents will take on as much debt as they possibly can, up to and including the entire cost of tuition and room and board, which the federal government will let you do in most instances, you know, without much of a credit check. And parents willingly take that on because they think that it is their responsibility. And, you know, the government has something to say about this. There's this formula that sort of spits out a number when you apply for financial aid called the expected family, contribution. All three of those words are fascinating, right? There's an expectation from the government that you will pay a certain amount. Family means that everybody has to contribute. You know, once upon a time, parents would send kids off to college with a pat on the back and expect them to, you know, work in the fraternity house as a waiter 20 hours a week, and that would pay for all of school. But, you know, apparently nowadays the family must all contribute. And then contribution, right?
Mm-hmm.
Contribution implies that you have the money on hand. It doesn't necessarily imply indebtedness. And yet here we are with two-thirds of all people graduating from college with an average of $30,000 in debt. And that's not counting what the parents take on or what they yank out of their home equity. So it's complicated.
Yep. Ron Lieber, personal finance columnist for The New York Times, out with his new book, The Opposite of Spoiled. I want to remark about the title again, and I like your approach in this book. The jacket design of your book shows three jars full of coins and dollar bills, each of them pretty full. One is marked give, one is marked save, one is marked spend. So you get the three-pronged approach there toward money, Ron. I like this. I guess your aim here was to present the ideal, kids who are grounded, generous, but also smart about their money.
You've got it. And there's two different ways to think about the jars. On a very practical level, it's the sort of basic foundation for allowance. And it looks a lot like a basic adult budget, right? You know, we spend, if we're doing okay, right? You know, mm-hmm. we're spending maybe 80% of what we make. We're putting away 15% if we're doing really well, you know, some for retirement, maybe some for college savings, or maybe it's 10% of whatever you can do. And then we give as generously as we can. Now, most Americans give away maybe 2 or 3% of their income on average. But, you know, if you're a person of faith, if you tithe, if you're Mormon, you may be giving away 10%. Or you may have signed the giving pledge if you're really wealthy and plan to give away half of what you have over the course of your life. But it's a basic adult budget. But the other thing I like about the three jars is that they are stand-ins for the values and virtues and character traits that we want to imprint on our kids. So spending is really about modesty and prudence and thrift, but also making a careful assessment of what we really want to splurge on. So this is not about, you know, purely being thrifty. It's about picking the things that make us most happy, spending money on those. With saving, it's about delayed gratification and patience in a world that conspires against it, particularly with children. And giving is about generosity and ultimately gratitude, which is good for all of us.
410-662-8780 is the phone number here for Midday. Our toll-free long-distance number, 866-661-9309. The Midday email address, midday@wypr.org. I give all that contact information so that you can reach us if you'd like to speak with Ron Lieber, a personal finance columnist for The New York Times, during this hour of Midday. So we'll take a break here, Ron. We'll come back and talk some more and get some advice about how to talk to kids of all ages about money. And we'll start young. We'll go with the 4 and 5 year olds who start asking questions about money. How do you handle that? Ron Lieber is here to help. More on Midday when we get back. And welcome back to the Midday Show. Dan Roderick's here with Ron Lieber of the New York Times, personal finance columnist of the Times, now with a new book from Harper. It's the publisher, The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. So on the spoiled, unspoiled thing, I think we have to talk about this a little bit, Ron, especially with little kids. As kids are growing up in a house, a lot of parents feel like, okay, I don't spoil them. I motivate them. You know, I give them things. I buy them things in return for, I don't know, good grades in school, keeping their room clean, I don't know, dangling goods in front of kids to get a good behavior. And I don't feel like I'm spoiling my kids by doing that.
It's a difficult thing to measure. On one hand, the word spoiled, you know, means different things to different people, although I think we all know at least some spoiled children, and we know them when we see them. but it's really a qualitative exercise in trying to identify one. It's not quantitative, although there has been some work done on materialism in particular and coming up with sort of materialism scores by putting kids and adults through tests. So, you know, there are ways to measure it quantitatively. But, you know, I think to take a step back, we want to try and define what we actually mean by that term other than, you know, I know it when I see it. And, you know, I think about it in a couple ways. And I try to remind people that, you know, it doesn't take a lot of money to spoil a child. The material possessions and the incredible experiences are only one small part of it, and only if the kids feel entitled to them. The other ways that kids are spoiled is when they don't really have to answer to anyone. They have no responsibilities in the household, nothing that they have to do for other people, no rules. Or if they do have rules and there are no consequences when they break them, then, you know, that creates a sense of entitlement that they can more or less do as they please. And, you know, we also hear a lot about helicopter parenting these days. I think that's a related matter, right? When kids are lavished with time and attention, not the normal amount developmentally where we help them, but we also let them fail as much as possible. What we're talking about here is, you know, so much time and so much attention that the kids don't actually end up doing very much for themselves and can't pick themselves up off the floor when they fall down.
What are the traits, what are the benefits of the unspoiled child on that side of it? I don't want to assume that we all understand that that's a better thing, but there are benefits to the unspoiled child.
Sure. So when I first got started thinking about this, it was because some parents had asked me to come speak in their community about issues of social class and all of the complicated questions that kids were asking that the parents didn't know how to answer. And it occurred to me that the one thing that everybody had in common for sure, no matter how much money they had, was that nobody wants to raise a spoiled child because it's something that you do to them. And so I tried to identify all of these values and virtues and character traits that added up to the opposite of spoiled so we could try and tack towards those. And yeah, wrote down things like modesty and patience and generosity and perspective on your place in the world and who has more and who has less and curiosity about how all that came to pass and grit and perseverance. And I looked at that list and I thought, whoa, you can use money to teach every single one of those things. So rather than assume that money subverts values, what if we did the inverse and embraced the questions and the money conversations that follow and tried to steer all of these complicated kids' questions towards an answer and a conversation or even a family ritual around saving and spending and giving that actually cements these great values that help us produce decent, grounded children?
Back to the point I was making there about using money or using rewards for good behavior. And the converse of that, you know, taking things away when kids are bad, when kids don't do what you want them to do, is a form of punishment. Now, is that a good model? That's the one that's been used quite a bit over the years.
Sure. So all of the research on this in terms of, you know, rewarding kids for good behavior or good grades suggests that it reduces something called intrinsic motivation. That's a fancy, you know, psychologist and academic term for, you know, their own internal motivation to do things just for the pleasure of learning and getting smarter and making their brain bigger. So, you know, the general sense is that it's probably not a great idea to bribe your kids or pay them off when their grades are good. And I have a similar feeling about allowance and the connection between allowance and chores. The vast majority of parents exchange money for the completion of chores in a satisfactory way. But I would much rather see parents separate the two because I think money is a tool for learning the same way that art supplies are or a musical instrument or books. And you don't take those away when the kids aren't doing their chores very well. So I don't think you should take allowance away either. And so if you want to exact leverage on your kids for when they don't do their chores or don't do them well, it's better to take away privileges that they really care a lot about. Screen time, car keys, cell phones, you name it. I mean, whatever they like to do the most, take that. And I think you'll have even more leverage with that than you will by withholding allowance.
I want to talk about what you describe as a natural curiosity that kids have about money. And I'm wondering, maybe this is a generational thing? This is a consumer, crazy consumer culture we've lived in now for, several decades. Is that something new? Have kids always been curious about money, the way money's handled, the way it moves through a household, how much dad makes, mom makes? You think kids are naturally curious about money?
I do. I think some of it is timeless and some of it is timely. The timeless aspect of this is the fact that kids are born to be curious. It is, in fact, their jobs to figure out how the world works.
That's right.
Right? And it's our job to teach them. We're in the adult-making business here, right? And so they will naturally ask all sorts of questions about all sorts of things. And, you know, I think it's clear to them from an early age that money is a source of great power and mystery. And so, of course, they're going to ask questions about it. So I think that's sort of time immemorial, right? But what's changed is a couple of things. So first of all, many parents, maybe even the vast majority, are spending most of their money via plastic and not via hard currency. So there isn't a direct connection between watching what your parents do and, you know, sort of seeing if a lot of bills or just a few bills are being laid on the counter. You don't see a lot of cash laying around. You don't really get to play with it unless you have allowance. So things are even more sort of confusing on that front. I mean, it took me a good year to explain to my daughter the connection between the debit card and the ATM machine and the direct deposit paycheck. I mean, she never sees any of this stuff.
Right,
it all
happens
in plastic land, in the ether.
Right.
So, you know, it took a while for her to even get it. And then I think, you know, the other thing that's going on is that it's so much easier for them to look things up that they're curious about. I mean, the moment they have unfettered internet access or even occasional access and they can read and they know what Google is, I mean, the first thing they'll probably do is, you know, type in their address or their name to see what pops up. And the first thing that'll often pop up when you type in your address is how much Zillow thinks your home is worth. And so they get this number that may be, you know, bigger than any number they've ever seen or contemplated. They think they're rich. They don't know what a mortgage is. And their head starts spinning with all this craziness. And maybe they'll ask us and maybe they won't. But I think we have to assume that they're picking all of this stuff up and that we have to engage them on all of these topics eventually over the, you know, 10 or 12 years that we've got them with us and they're capable of understanding it.
The question is when then, isn't it?
It is. And I think it starts at 5 or 6. Often a great time to start is when a child loses his or her first tooth, because the tooth fairy comes and quite often the tooth fairy brings some money and the kids wake up to this money and they realize that they could use it to buy things that they want. But quite often the tooth fairy hasn't brought enough to buy much of anything, and so they want more. And that's the point at which you introduce allowance and allow them to start practicing with money.
Ron, you had a piece recently in the Times in the Your Money column, January 29th. Why should you tell your children how much you make? Why you should tell your children how much you should make?
Mm-hmm.
Why should
so that was,
you? Yeah, why should
yeah,
you?
It was an excerpt from the book, and you know, I knew all along that was probably the most provocative piece of advice that I was going to give out, and so you know, I wanted to put it in the newspaper too, just to you know, get some feedback from the New York Times readers who were
very smart. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were I don't know how many several hundred comments and a lot of really concerned email about the state of my mind. but you know, some people weren't reading it all that carefully. They saw the headline and immediately dropped their jaws. No, look, I don't think kids should know how much you make until they are at least 16 or 17 years old, and you have taken them through a decade-long process of getting them ready to handle that information. So it's 4 years of allowance and it's 4 more years of introducing them to the idea of the household budget so they know what you're spending money on, so that they understand mortgages and they understand all of the different monthly expenses to maintain the house, so that they understand insurance. And, you know, and if that doesn't put them to sleep, you can walk them through the grocery budget and you can put them in charge of their own clothing and their extracurricular activity budget. And then there's a couple of years at least of really gauging their discretion. Are they keeping their friends' secrets? Are they keeping their siblings' secrets? are they good about keeping private family information private, or are they going into school to talk about the fights that you're having with your spouse, if you have one, or the conversations that you have on the phone with other people about your life, if you're a single parent and spend a lot of time on the phone talking to family and friends. And you have to say to them, look, we think it's very important that you have this information, that you know what it takes to create and support a life like the one that we have, however lavish or modest it may be, right? This is what it takes. As we want you to know, as you begin to think about where you're going to go to school and how much debt you're going to take on, and you try to figure out what kind of life you would like to make for yourself, it's important to know what it takes, but you have to keep it to yourself. And this is a test of your maturity. And most kids are going to want to pass that test when parents frame it for them in that way.
Yeah, that's good, Ron. I mean, you're treating them as an adult at that point, really. You know,
well, they almost are adults.
Yeah, of course they
right?
are.
I mean, they're about to make this insane six-figure decision at the age of 16 or 17. What choice do we have but to treat them as adults? And oh, by the way, if they're applying for financial aid and you're filling out the FAFSA form,
form
is going to have all the information on it.
Right. That's very interesting what you just ran down there, these gradual steps toward that understanding and treating them as an adult so they, in asking them for that discretion, that confidence. I think a lot of people assume that kids just pick up or through, I don't know what, osmosis, watching you sitting at a desk writing checks and mailing off bills, that they understand that there's a gas bill, there's an electric bill, maybe one and the same, there's a cell phone bill, there's the credit card bill, and the credit card bill includes all that, that stuff that you never see. But I think maybe parents assume that just by being in the household, kids absorb this information, that, you know, it can cost $300, $400 a month for gas and electric, or that the car payment is $287. They may not know specifically the number, but you assume that they know you're paying for the car. It just didn't magically appear in the driveway.
I think parents assume a lot, and I think kids absorb a lot, but they're kids. So they're going to absorb many of the wrong things, or even if they hear the right numbers, they're going to put them in the wrong context. And then there are things that, you know, parents are embarrassed about or places they don't want to go. I've heard all sorts of stories of kids who are 9, 10, 11, 12 years old have been in private school their whole lives. They don't actually know that their parents are writing a check for them to go. And parents are uncomfortable having that conversation with kids sometimes because they don't want their kids to feel guilty, or they don't want their kids to know just how much extra money they have, or they don't want their kids to know that the grandparents are paying for it. They don't want their kids to know that they are on financial aid at the school, and they don't want to have to explain, okay, why are you paying for me to go to school when I have friends who go to school for free in the neighborhood or in the next town over? These are all complicated conversations, and I understand why people dodge having them, but I mean, this is the reality that we live with and live in, and, you know, we should be having these conversations with kids as they age.
Otherwise, you end up with a crash course for a 20-something son or daughter who is maybe moving into a household, going out on their own, renting an apartment, and discovering, whoa, look at this bill, look at that bill. I mean, it'd be real. Let's talk about sticker shock, real shock. So you end up in a crash course in their 20s.
That's the best case scenario. A far more common scenario is that kids graduate and they get their first paycheck. And I've heard these stories repeatedly. And they come home and call their parents weeping because nobody ever explained to them that 20 or 30% of the money was going to disappear for taxes.
Yeah.
And they hadn't budgeted for that. They thought that their starting salary was actually going to be what it said it was. But in fact, it is not. And they just didn't know that, right? Or they don't get their act together when they graduate and they've got, you know, a couple different student loans from different providers, and the student loan company sends notes to their home, or they're not checking their email because many 22-year-olds don't even bother with email anymore. And so the debts, the first payments, the first bills come due, and the kids don't even know that they're supposed to be paying, or they kind of blow it off, or they pay late, and all of a sudden at the age of 23 or 24, they've got a real credit score problem. So again, you know, these are all things that we have to teach them. And given the increasing necessity of winning your 20s financially, right, you don't want to be starting your retirement savings at 32. You lose 10 years of really valuable compounding, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, all the more reason, right, to have explained all this to your kids so that they know that this is how, you know, grown-ups do it if they possibly can afford to, right? They put money away. They pay the bills on time. You know, there are consequences to not doing those things, and that if at all possible, if you're gainfully employed, you need to do all these things too, sooner rather than later.
Speaking of the first paycheck, when kids have when the kids are younger, they're still in your household, and maybe they pick up a part-time job, a summer job, or they, I don't know, cut grass or do something like that to make some money. Or maybe they get a real paycheck. They come home with a paycheck at the age of, 14 or 15. And next thing you know, they own something that they didn't own before. They blew a lot of the first paycheck on something. And you say, well, what did you do that for? You know, you're supposed to save money. Well, you never had that conversation with me, Dad. I thought this is my money. I can do with it what I want. So let's talk a little bit about that. The kids' expectation that the money is theirs from a part-time job while they're still in your household, but maybe you have different ideas about what that money should be used for.
Sure. I mean, I don't think this is a close call. They're working because you give them permission to. Maybe you're driving them to the job, or you're, you know, giving them money for gas for the car if they are driving themselves. You've bought them the bicycle. You know, you've given them permission to do it. By all means, your rules still apply. And, you know, I think you can be as strict as you want to be. I think the banned item list still applies. Just because they've made the money doesn't mean they can now buy violent video games or pierce their navel or get a tattoo or buy a scooter, right? You know, that can happen when they're 18 and maybe they're not living with you anymore. But I think your rules still apply in the meantime. Now, I think you should reward them for their diligence. I think you should try and give them a little more leeway. But you may also be in a situation where they are working because they have to, or because they've decided, you know what, I really want to reach for that private college. I'm worried about student loan debt because you explained that to me starting at age 13 or 14. And I want to save as much as I possibly can so that I don't have to borrow as much and so that I can go to any college that I want to. In which case, you know, they will bring their own discipline to the table. But, you know, you can help them. You can help remind them that there are easy ways to automate savings and, you know, take the money out of their paychecks or take most of it out of it and put it away someplace safe where they can't easily get to it. These are all things that kids don't know how to do, and it's our job to help them.
Ron Lieber is our guest in this hour of Midday on WYPR, the Your Money columnist for the New York Times, out with a new book called The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. I have some emails to read for Ron when we get back after this break. We can also take phone calls with your comments or questions. How do you talk to your kids about money? What kind of conversations have you had with them? If you're curious about how to even broach the subject with your son or daughter, give us a ring. Here's how you reach us. 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance for the Midday Show is 866-661-9309. Again, our email address, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back, everybody. Ron Lieber is our guest in this hour of the show, the Your Money columnist, personal finance columnist of the New York Times. The new book, The Opposite of Spoiled, it's about kids and money, raising kids who are grounded, generous, and smart about money. A question from Mo, Ron. The conversation about cars is complicated. If you expect that you will be passing a car down to your child when they learn to drive, how do you still instill a sense of responsibility for that car? Meaning ahead of time.
It's a, right? Yeah, it's a tricky one, right? Because in every category of spending, and even in every kind of micro category, say within clothing, I think every parent should set up what I call a want-need continuum, right? So you're thinking about these objects or these items or these privileges. Is it a want or is it a need? And cars are a complicated one, right? Because once kids have them, parents don't have to worry as much, or maybe they worry a little bit more, but at least they're not responsible during that moment for dropping the kids off and picking them up. And maybe if it's an older child and there are younger siblings around, the older kid can now ferry the siblings around, do errands for the parents. That means the parents can work more. They can be more efficient. They can make more money. So, you know, the kid may actually be contributing by having a car. But if a car is a want, is something that's not strictly necessary, if the kid could take the bus, then that's something else entirely. So, you know, depending on where you are with the car on the want-need continuum, I think that governs how you answer the question. But even if the car is purely a need and it helps the parents earn more and it makes total economic sense to do so, I think there should be all sorts of rules about how the car is cared for. Again, this is part of being in the adult-making business. Are they paying attention to the warning lights? What is the gas budget? And how do you decide how to set it? How often can they take it to do things that are fun? And under what circumstances can they have more than one other person in the house? What are the rules about that? And what are the consequences for breaking the rules? So, you know, these are all questions that you have to ask, up to and including how much financial responsibility the kid should take on. And again, I think if the car is tilting more towards a want than towards a need, then the kid should have to contribute more and more and more money up and until the point, you know, that they may decide that maybe they don't actually want to use the car so much. I profiled a family in the book that takes a Zipcar approach to the family car. So the older child does not have his own car. And when it comes to using the parents' car, he can use it whenever he wants, but they literally rent it out as if it were a Zipcar. So, you know, he pays by the hour. I think he gets his gas for free, but he pays by the hour for every hour of usage. And so it makes him think twice about taking the car to school and having it sit in the lot for 6 or 7 hours because the tab is running.
That's a high school kid.
It's a high school kid.
Yeah, that's good. That's interesting, Ron. All right, so you're walking down the street with your 7-year-old daughter, and it's a busy time. It's cold. You're moving fast because you got to get somewhere, and there's a panhandler who sticks his hand out and says, you got something for me? I'm hungry. Need to get bus fare or something like that. But you brush by, and just another panhandler. You see them all the time because you work in the city, and your daughter happens to be with you this day. It's on the weekend, but you need to get somewhere, and your daughter says, why don't you give that man some money? So you want to tackle that one?
Yeah, I mean, this comes up all the time for people who live in urban areas, and it's especially shocking for kids who are not in urban areas all that often, but then arrive in one and find that there are a lot of people asking for money, and it's very confusing, and they feel badly, and they should. I think there's a couple ways to handle this, and it sort of happens in stages according to the ages. So, you know, with the youngest kids, you know, ages 3 to 6 or 7, I think you ought to just hand over some money each and every time because it models compassion. And I am well aware of the fact that giving money to some people on the street may not be the most helpful thing to do. And it may, in fact, be harmful if they have addiction issues or psychological issues, mental health issues. I get that. But I also think it's important to model compassion. And then at, you know, 6 or 7 or 8, you can begin to explain to kids why it may not be helpful to give people money. And maybe a better thing to do would be to give them something that is useful. So, you know, I profiled in the book a family in Oakland that created these bags, and the kids went to Costco with their allowance and with their charity money. And they bought a bunch of things to put in bags to give out when they see homeless people in the median when they're stopped at a light in the East Bay east of San Francisco. And so, you know, it's power bars and packets of tissues and pens and paper and hats and gloves, you know, things that might be useful to somebody who doesn't have any place to live. And then the next step is to explain to kids, you know what, there are issues in the government and issues in our city or town that impact how we treat these people and how it might have come to pass that they ended up living in the street in the first place. And so we can give money to organizations in our community that can help them directly and are better than we are at knowing how to use the money. And so we're going to trust them and give money to them, and we can feel good about that, knowing that we're doing it. Maybe even, you know, each and every time that you see someone who you want to help, You know, you can go online with your phone, you know, once you turn the ignition off in the car, and, you know, put another $5 towards helping that organization help the people that you've seen.
Thank you, Ron. Let's take another call. This is Sarah in Bel Air in Harford County. Sarah, go right ahead. You're on with Ron Lieber.
Hi. First of all, I cannot tell you like how exciting this segment has been for me. My husband and I have a 2.5-year-old, and we're expecting another baby soon. And it's just something we talk about a lot, just kind of trying to instill just different financial values than we had been raised with, or mainly than I've been raised with. But super exciting. Anyways, I heard you talking about the, like, starting allowance after the tooth fairy comes. Like, that's when it's a good time to kind of implement, okay, now you can kind of earn money. And I'm just not sure, like, how you even start that process, though, even once the tooth fairy comes.
How do you start the allowance process?
Yeah.
Okay, Ron.
Sure. It is a process, and I'm glad that she used that word to describe it, because it is a little bit of a design challenge, a user experience challenge, right? On one hand, you want to have the vessels, right? And traditionally, we all used piggy banks, but I don't like piggy banks very much. I don't like the metaphor that there's something piggish about saving money or spending it or even giving it away. It's like you're hoarding or something, you know, rooting around in the mud. It's a terrible animal to use. And most piggy banks are opaque, so you can't actually see what's going inside, and, you know, it's difficult to get the money out. I like big, wide-mouthed jars. Families tend to tilt towards plastic because those don't break. But you can use glass jars if you think your kids are not going to, you know, bust the mason jars and cut their hands, right? And you want them big enough so that the money piles up. And you give, you know, a couple bucks each week, maybe 50 cents for every year that they have been on the planet. But also so that it works out into, you know, even dollars. And maybe it's a dollar in each jar, or maybe it's $2 in each jar. And then you have to make sure that you have the singles on hand at the appointed hour on the appointed day. So you have to think through that, right? So you can pull singles out of your wallet every day, or you can join the local credit union in your building, or go down to the bank and break a 20 and keep a stack of all those singles. And you have to, there's some design thinking involved here. and then you have to remember to hand the money over, and you need a calendar alert so that you do that, so that it becomes a regular part of your life. So that's how you begin to sort of set up those systems. And eventually, after a couple of years of the kids having the visceral experience of holding the money and counting it, you can maybe switch to a virtual system.
You know, when you were talking before about how you're the parent, they're living in your household, and even a part-time job is made possible for them by your driving them to them or something. So you have a lot of rights here. Is it by having those rules about how money that's earned will be spent or saved? Is that how kids develop a sense of self-control when it comes to money?
Well, to me, the question of self-control is related to patience, right, and delayed gratification.
Right.
And that, to me, is why I think it's important to always have them saving for something so that they understand how it feels after 3 to 6 months when they're younger, or maybe after 4 years during high school. To have achieved a sizable goal. And to a smaller child, a sizable goal might be saving up enough for, well, what my daughter did. She decided that she didn't like the color pink on her walls anymore. And our response to her was, you picked the color pink back when we needed to paint your room, but we no longer need to paint your room because that paint is still just fine. So because you want to replace the paint, you are going to need to pay for it. And she decided that that was important enough to her that she devoted all of her birthday and holiday money and all of her allowance savings towards that. And a couple $100 later, she had bought the paint and she hired the handyman. She got it all done because we weren't going to pay for it. It was
right.
a want and
right.
not
it was
a need.
Want,
it was
not
totally
a need.
Totally unnecessary, but we were happy to let her do that if she felt strongly enough about it. And, you know, the walls of her quote unquote new room give her great joy. And so, you know, so that was a pretty good distance for her to stick to that for 12 to 18 months.
And she felt good about that.
she felt great about it. It was all on her, and she made it happen. And, you know, for older kids, you know, maybe it's 4 years of saving so that they can buy or contribute to the cost of a vehicle, or 4 years of saving so that they can buy or contribute to the cost of college tuition, or maybe just their first semester. You know, I profile a family in the book that forces all the kids, all four kids, to pay for the first semester of college tuition, not room and board, which, you know, might put the number into the stratosphere, but the $10,000 or $15,000 or $17,000 that it costs for tuition alone, and every kid did it.
Interesting stuff. Let's take another call for Ron Lieber. Hazel, also calling from Harford County in Abingdon. Go right ahead, Hazel.
Well, I just wanted to share with you what we did with our daughter, but you need to keep these numbers in mind for the years. So in the late 80s and early 90s is what I'm talking about. So you'd have to extrapolate it for now. We went cross country for a month, and I can't stand whiny kids. Drive me crazy. I was a teacher, so you didn't get to whine in my classroom. So what we did is every single morning we got up, we gave her $25, and that is what she used for souvenirs and food. And at the end of the month, Larry and I came home with no money in our pocket, and she had $300. So we always think that's funny.
Wait, excuse me, $25 a day?
Right, $25 a day.
Wait, this was during vacation?
But that was just for her.
This is for her. She could spend it any way she wanted, and she couldn't ask us for any more money.
So you were not paying for her meals?
No, we were not paying for
meals. So meal money was involved in this?
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And we aren't extravagant.
All right.
I absolutely love this. You know, I've heard versions of this from families who go on vacation. Quite often it's a Disney World issue or a Disneyland issue where every time you turn around, you know, commerce and those god dang ears are in your face, and now all the frozen stuff, right?
Right.
And the parents, you know, will not harbor any whining. And they say to the kids at the beginning of the trip, look, here is a prepaid debit card that has, you know, $50 on it, or here is a $100 bill. It is all yours, but there is no more where this comes from. And you decide what you want, and we're not going to, you know, question it. Most of the stuff at Disney is wholesome, as long as you don't mind all the princess stuff in your face and in your house for years afterwards. But I haven't heard about someone extending that to meals on a trip.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's brilliant. I mean, again, if they want responsibility, we should give it to them. If they want to make financial choices, we should let them. Almost inevitably, they will screw it up in any number of ways. But sometimes you get a child like our callers who takes this as a challenge and decides that the things that are going on the trip, whether it's the souvenirs that are, you know, possible purchases, or the meal upgrades, right, the dessert, the beverage, the things that are completely optional, that are wants and not needs, she's going to avoid all those. She's going to be thrifty and prudent because she's got her eyes on something else at home, some other product or experience that's going to make her much happier than all of those incremental desserts or souvenirs would have. And she's going to wait. And that is spectacular.
We received an email from Alice in Frederick, Maryland, Ron, who said she sat her son down at the age of 6 or 7 and told him how much she made and how much the household costs were, expenses were. He said, you know, and he took to this and he understood it. She says that when he received money for his birthdays, at first he wanted to buy something right away. But I suggested, you know, if you wait until Christmas, you could get that expensive game you really want. But it's up to you. Sometimes he would get something right away, but most of the time he would save his money. That's from Alice in Frederick. And we're out of time. I thought I would end with that email. Ron, this has been most entertaining and interesting. Lots of great ideas here, and more in Ron Lieber's book. Ron Lieber, of course, the personal finance columnist of the New York Times. He writes the Your Money column. This is his third book. It's called The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. Ron, it was great to have you on the show again. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for tuning into our midday show. I hope you enjoyed it. For our board operator engineer, Luke Spicknell, have a great afternoon. We'll see you again in 22 hours for another edition of Midday.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richmond, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Rogic's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.